in with this one. All right. Welcome to this episode of Bringing Home the Bacon, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle, joined by my always Lopez lover co-host, Tim. How you doing?
I'm doing quite well. How are you?
Not too bad. I went to a dollar store today. I haven't been in a dollar store, I don't know how long, but I had to go there for work. And they have, like, so much fucking shit. I was so excited. Like, I found, I'm just thinking of it because I was looking at it now. They had, like, metallic marker pens. So I'm, like, getting them for Gundams and shit. And I was like, oh, this fucking sucks. But
that's a good idea.
Yeah, so that's some good news. So I just wanted to let you know that, because I do have some bad news, Tim, for you.
We ran out of time again?
Yeah, we're not going to have time to talk about the episode of George Lopez where Carmen is turning 15 and she wants to have a quinceañera. George wants to cancel the party because money is tight, so he's not working, but Angie says it's her money and starts making money decisions without George's consent. We actually have a really good episode. I am super excited. We're going to be talking to creator, writer, Richard Ashley Hamilton about his amazing series Scoop and the second volume that's coming out, was it February 23rd, Richard?
That's right, and it does have a quinceañera, although the George Lopez one, man, that's where it's at. I don't know if I'm gonna be able to live up to that one. What's he gonna do? These things are expensive.
Yeah, I don't know. And Carmen's, she's picky, so I'm not sure. Yeah, I was very excited. I'm pretty sure at this point we've run through every episode, but when I can tie on it very closely, I am excited.
Oh, so that was an actual episode. You weren't just making that up.
Yeah, no, I pulled them from actual episodes. Yeah, I'm not that clever. I mean, some of their episodes are like so batshit insane. We could probably just make them up. In general, I don't think people would know, even though everyone on the earth has probably seen every episode without knowing it. But
clearly, I wouldn't know, but I do know the results would be hilarious. So yeah, that's what matters.
But I am very excited. I was familiar with Scoop Volume 1, and I was excited about it. I mean, first off, because I think Insight, which does comics, but I think a lot of people know them from working in a bookstore. I know them from, like, a lot of their, like, movie and, like, entertainment books. Yeah, but they put out, like, some really sick comic stuff. They put out a Gypsy omnibus. I mean, it was, like, last year. It's, like, this hardcover with, like, a slipcase, and it's, like, this European book they, like, re-released.
Yeah, they do a lot of great BD kind of books, and, you know, they did the Mike Allred Bowie one that came out last year, which was killer, and they've got a lot of great stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's why, like, I am excited for selfish reasons, because, like, they put out, like, really nice versions of comics, so, like, having them put out these is nice. I mean, obviously, the art, the writing is fantastic in these, but, oh, that art in this, especially in Pablo, oh, so fucking good, man. I'm so excited to, like, have a physical copy of this, man.
Isn't he, we almost didn't get him. We got samples for him. He did, I don't want to give you spoilers, but he did two pages. One was in the beginning, which Insight has kind of since made public and run up to the release of the book. And it's kind of like with the gray man alien as he teleports away. And then there's another page that he did that's at the very end of the book. And it's kind of like the big climax, and it's raining. That's all I'll tell you. I know you've read it, but I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read the second book yet. But that sample was amazing, and then we almost lost him because I think he got offered something. It might have been like for Marvel or DC, and you know he's that good. But somehow Insight was able to keep him, and made me very, very happy.
Yeah, it's the series itself kind of delves into fringe paranormal stuff, and like almost kind of like what Dark Ritual you have done to get like Joseph Cooper and Pablo on these books, because like they're insane.
I've gotten some crazy stuff in my past life. No, honestly, that's just a testament to Insight. Mark Irwin was the editor on the first volume, and the second volume, and then Holly Fisher has also edited the second volume. But you know, they have great relationships with talent out there, and I had not seen Pablo's stuff before this, but once they started showing me some of his samples and he did a couple of pages, you know, from the script, I was sold. And then they got Kike to do the colors, and I think they work really well together too. And it's kind of weird, like I guess I sort of come a little bit from like the I don't want to say the Alan Moore school, like where it takes like 8 pages to describe one panel of a comic, you know, but maybe it's more like the Greg Rucka school. Like, I'm big into reference and a lot of photo reference, and it's set in Miami, which is my hometown. So I gave them in the script a lot of reference of like specific locations, and I just wanted to feel like it was really taking place there. And it was kind of interesting. They followed some of the reference, but not all of it. But even when they didn't follow the reference, it somehow felt like Miami to me. Like, they were just able to capture the spirit of it without having to like light box a specific photo of a specific location in South Florida.
I think that's one of the really interesting things about the book, that the city of Miami, like, where obviously there is kind of like the setting of it, but it is very much a character of the book. And I think having it kind of center around this news team and Sophie being this like kind of intrepid journalist, like, that obviously kind of like indelves her into that world. But like, it does really feel like it's so ingrained in the story. I mean, was that just kind of wanting to work in your hometown, feeling comfortable, or like, what made you want to set it like so much in Miami and really like it kind of be a like third character in the story?
Yeah, I mean, it was a couple of things. You know, I mean, I never really appreciated Miami when I lived there, but when I graduated college and moved to LA, I really missed it and sort of retroactively realized just what a great place it is. I mean, it's certainly got its problems. The traffic is horrible. The people can be jerks, and it can get super hot and humid. But, you know, for the most part, it's got a lot going for it. It's a very diverse. There's a lot of culture and just a lot of things that I kind of miss living in LA. So, you know, part of it was to be a love letter to my hometown. Part of it was, you know, just I think you can tell, like, some of the influences on Scoop are like other detective, you know, kind of stories, books, shows, comics. And my favorite ones are the ones that very much are like set in a place. And, you know, if you're watching an old film noir, like, there's no mistaking it's L.A. in most cases. And with, like, to invoke Greg Rucka again, like, Stumptown is one of my favorites. And that's, you know, so definitely set, you know, in and around Portland. So, and I don't know, I just really dig that. I think it makes it very specific. And there's, I mean, let's be honest, there's a lot of girl detective stories out there. So I was looking for things that would be unique to Scoop. But also stuff that I could write credibly to, because I figure if the real world stuff, if the setting stuff feels legit, then we're maybe going to be more likely to go with Sophie when we get into like some of the more far out sci-fi stuff that I'm making up, you know?
Yeah. And I think Florida in general, I think for a lot of people is, you know, the Florida man jokes and everything. But I think like, Miami's often kind of like able to like circumvent that, and like it is like the cultural hub of it, but it's like a perfect setting for this, because again, you get that like city element, but you know, it's still down south, so you can kind of have the marsh element, you can kind of almost like bring in the like paranormal, like dark aspects of like a New Orleans type setting. Like, it is like a perfect thing. And like, living in upstate New York, I get a lot of that, where like upstate New York is a shithole, like it's the worst, but like, we have New York City, like I can still claim that somewhat. I can be like, oh, you know, all New York's not terrible, there's some culture down there. And it feels like Miami's like the saving grace of Florida in a lot of instances.
Well, when do they say that the further north you go in Florida, the deeper south you go? You know, I don't know, there's a lot of good aspects to Florida. There's some bad aspects to Florida. You can say that about any state, I guess. But Miami is like this weird outlier, and it's very different than the rest of Florida. And it's, obviously has a huge Latin influence from Cuba and Puerto Rico and also South America. It's kind of like just got this amazing location because it's, you know, you get a lot of European business in Miami. You get a lot of South American business. You get business from New York and the West Coast. Like, it all kind of converges around Miami, which makes it, again, just a really unique locale. And it kind of, you know, to your other point you're raising about, like, why Miami and why South Florida, I remember being a kid and Sylvester Stallone moved to Miami. Was doing this movie called The Specialist with Sharon Stone, which is awful, but it was very exciting at the time. And I think Madonna had just moved to Miami not long before that, and everyone's kind of feeling like, oh my god, we're gonna live like in the new Hollywood and it's gonna be super exciting. And stupid Miami like immediately overtaxed Sylvester Stallone and Madonna, and they were like, well, we're out. And so like all these promises of them bringing like the new Hollywood to Miami just went with them. So I don't know. I was just trying to shine a spotlight back on Miami. Not that a comic book is going to equal a Sylvester Stallone blockbuster movie in the 1990s.
Right. Well, I guess speaking of money, so some people might know you from your work on How to Train a Dragon and then the Trollhunter stuff. And I know you've done like comics in that realm, but like, What is kind of like the appeal of wanting to tell comic stories? And then I think both of these ones in kind of the longer form one, which I really enjoy. I mean, why would you want to go from, I'm imagining you're still doing both, but like, you know, why would you want to come to comics and not make any money? Because it's awful.
Yeah, I had an editor at Dark Horse, Randy Stradley, and I was doing these Dragons comics. I said, yeah, I want to do more comics. And he said, of course, why wouldn't you? There's literally dozens of dollars to be made. And that pretty much sums it up. You know, you just do comics for the love. Like, I mean, that's how I learned to read and write, was reading comics. You know, like my grandfather smoked cigars at the time. He would go to a 7-Eleven, I would go with him, and there would be a spinner rack, and, you know, like, I couldn't take my eyes off of it, and, you know, I'd get comic books, and they were cheap back then, and, you know, get some candy, and like a whatchamacallit bar, I don't even know if those exist anymore, and he got his cigar, I got my comics and candy, and I was, like, set. So I feel like, you know, once you get bitten by that bug early on, it's really hard to shake, and it's kind of like my native like storytelling language. Like, even if I'm doing something in animation or something else, I'm always thinking in terms of like panels and just kind of breaking down the story sequentially that way. And I also think, like, you know, if you get to do different kinds of writing, I feel like comics is the most challenging. It's almost like boot camp for writing. Like, I feel like if you can write comic book scripts, you can write pretty much anything. Because you have to be so economical, you have to be so visual, you really have to like scrutinize every single word that you put in there and make sure that it's doing something for you and that every image and every action is doing something for you and it's pushing the characters and the plot forward. And if it isn't, you got to cut it out. You know, you don't want to waste the artist's time or the reader's time or anyone else's. So I feel like if you can get kind of trained in that, then to like write an animation script or write a novel, I mean, I don't want to diminish it. Those are tough too, but it does feel a lot easier once you've done comics.
Is that something kind of working in both realms? And I mentioned this because I know you had retweeted it. And at some point it was like, I was reading reviews up kind of in prep for the interview. And like one of the really positive ones for Scoop One, like the one thing they mentioned was it kind of felt like, a spec script type thing, which I don't think it did. Like, I think it reads completely coherently as like one single story again, which I enjoy. But like, I think, I don't know if part of that was like them, like, you know, this is where Richard's coming from. And it feels like that going into two, having read two, I like loving the first one. I think like two is like leaps and bounds even better. Like I think coherently and like pace wise, it's insane. Like kind of what you pull off in this one. Was there anything you've learned from like going into comics and then kind of in this second volume? Is there anything you've approached differently or kind of taken differently as a writer of comics?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that about volume two. I feel that way about it myself. And I know the review you're talking about. I was actually messaging with that guy on Twitter not too long ago. And I think it was actually a legitimate criticism, although Scoop was never a pilot script. You know, there's since been interest in it after the fact, but at the time it was always meant to be a comic, always, from the beginning. But I kind of understand like the gist of the critique. And I think he was right. You know, I think the miscalculation I made with the first book, the main one, was I assumed the second book would be coming out like maybe 6 months later and not 2.5 years later. You know, so like there was stuff where I was like setting it up and it pays off in the second volume, which I think is okay if you only have to wait like, you know, what is it, like 3 months between like a Brubaker and Phillips book at this point, you know, right, like... So that was stupid of me to think that, but I think like you just learn from everything that you do, and I was very proud of the first book when it came out, but you know, I looked at it again and just saw like it does suffer from pilot-itis in that it's a lot of setup, and then you at the end, and I'm still proud of it. Everyone should still buy it, should still read it. This is not an indictment of that first book at all, but I think the second volume is better in that you know what it was? Insight, they were really nice. My editors gave me 4 extra pages and it allowed me to really like tie up everything a little neater than in the first book. So I feel like if you read the first volume now and you read the second one right after it, you're not going to have that same issue that other reviewer did. That said, the second volume is meant to be also very new reader friendly. Like you do not need to read the first book to understand the second book. And that was done by design because I think we were just kind of watching the schedule change and seeing the delays with COVID and stuff and just thinking like, you know, even if people did read the first volume, they might've forgotten about it by now. There's a lot of great comics out there. So what can we do to make this as standalone as possible, but also as rewarding as possible to the people who read the first volume?
Yeah. And I definitely think it does that, but obviously, like, there's so much kind of character development and, like, so much payoff for Sophie, like, from 1 to 2, that it's really nice having read 1 and then reading 2 and going back and reading 1 kind of all in one sitting recently this week in, like, prep. Like, it's such a, like, nice and concise read. And I do like that first volume, like it's so, and I think beneficial, like it's so ambitious kind of what you're trying to pull off. Cause like on the surface in the way the book is generally pitched is like this, like young journalist, Sophie, who's like, you know, go get 'em. She's like in this internship, but she's also trying to like help her family. But then she's like trying to solve this mystery. Oh, and then on top of it, there's like this paranormal aspect. And like, it sounds like there's like a lot of like, you know, cooks in the kitchen, but like it's like so well like intertwined, and like nothing feels like it's like there for kind of the sake of it. Like I think we can kind of spoil maybe like the first volume, but like when you first see I'll just say like the river people, like when he just pops up and kind of directs her in one direction, like as a reader I'm like, whoa, what the fuck? And then but like, and you just kind of move from it, and it's like, I love that type of stuff where it's not necessarily like, I don't need like a 40 page backstory on what that is. Maybe we'll get that eventually, but like she reacts to it. She has a reaction. Other people have reaction, but like the story just moves. Like it doesn't stop to take a breath for that. And like, I really enjoy that, but I can see at the same time, like when you're putting out, especially this kind of like longer narrative function of it, like being able to juggle all that being incredibly difficult, and then kind of doing it a second volume. Is that something working in this longer form function, being able to kind of juggle the many like kind of unique ideas you're trying to do at the same time? Is that difficult in kind of like paring it down into like a concise script and kind of what you want, especially when it's so character driven?
Well, I mean, I guess that is a challenge, but you know, that's the great thing about comics too, is like how collaborative they are. And so I feel like I've got, you know, Pablo and Kike to keep me honest on the art side, and you know, I had Holly and Mark editing me, and so they would point out things. Holly in particular was really instrumental in pointing out, like in the second volume, you know, we kind of have the true crime plot of Sophie reopening this investigation into like a very O.J. Simpson-like local celebrity in Miami, and he wants her help in finding the quote-unquote real killer of his ex-wife. And then there's also this other UFO plot. And in the first couple of drafts, those things were, I think, a little, they were sort of like on parallel paths. And Holly was the one who's like, is there any way to intertwine these more? And once she gave me that note, it really unlocked the story for me. And then I was able to go in and start having these scenes and these bits of dialogue do double duty. So I think that maybe if you feel that anything is kind of tightly woven or ingrained in there, that's really thanks to Holly and that great note that she had. But yeah, it is fun, like, to be able to do the long-term kind of, you know, the larger format storytelling of, like, having the story carry from volume to volume. That honestly was the biggest challenge, was just trying to be patient, waiting for the second book to come out, you know, because I wanted to, like, make good on all these things we'd set up in the first book, like the alligatoids that you mentioned. In the first book, they do appear, and it does feel almost random. Like, I was thinking kind of a lot of, like, you know, Coen Brothers kind of stories where just sort of weird stuff happens, and the joy in it is like the way people react to it. But my bet at the time also was that I feel like comic readers in particular are very savvy now and know that, and have been for a very long time. I feel like the rest of the world's kind of catching up to us, but they know that if something like that gets planted in there, it's going to pay off. And if it's not in this volume, it'll be in a future volume. So it feels pretty good to start to make good on some of those promises.
So you brought up O.J. Simpson, which makes me want to ask, since you're familiar with him, did he do it?
Did I do it?
No, did he do
Oh,
it?
did no, I didn't do no. Yeah, man, of course he did it. I mean, yeah, and by the way, what a great plot element for an all ages comic, right? Bringing in
Yeah,
O.J. Simpson.
exactly.
That was pretty inspired. I think he did it, you know. I mean, like, have you seen the O.J. Made in America documentary?
Yeah, it's
It's
very good, very long.
unbelievable. Yeah, it's like
It's
10
stone
hours
broken.
long, but it's, oh my God, it's so good. I mean, not to make light of the horrible, you know, crimes and stuff, but yeah, you know, I don't know. So after he was acquitted, right? Like, you know, there's the Bronco chase and the trial and, you know, the glove does not fit, you must quit and all that stuff. He had the civil trial, and they found him guilty, and he owed all this money. And what he did was he moved to Florida and Miami in particular, you know, as sort of like I don't know about like a tax shelter, but basically he was able to live there and not have to pay all that money that he owed the Perlman family and the Simpson family, not Simpson, his ex-wife's family. And Brown, Nicole Brown Simpson. So yeah, he like moved into our neighborhood basically. And you know, I don't know, I don't have like any DNA evidence that nobody else has, but I would like be at the movie theater with my family, and O.J. Simpson would walk in there, and his knees, it's kind of like, I don't know if you've seen like Dave Chappelle, like some of his most recent routines, he talks about O.J. Simpson. And he talks about how his knees are all shot and he's making fun of the way he walks. That's exactly the way it looked. He would come kind of like hobbling into the AMC movie theater. And it was crazy. He would be like waving at people. Like everyone stopped to look at him, but it was not like, oh my God, OJ, can I get your autograph? People were like kind of horrified. And he's waving, hey, how's it going? Hey. And then he would go, and I was in like an actual movie theater with him. And I don't remember what the movie was, which is weird. I usually have a pretty good memory for that. But I remember it was a comedy and nobody was laughing except for O.J. Simpson. It was like Cape Fear. He was just like laughing and clapping his hands, and everyone else is like, I'm in a movie theater with O.J. Simpson, like this guy. Basically, I'm in a movie theater with a murderer, you know? So, anyway, I don't. Yes, he did it.
Yes. If we could go back to that time where people were generally afraid of OJ when they saw him versus like him having followers on Twitter, that would be great if we could
Yeah, he's kind of come back
pass
around
around.
again.
Yeah, I don't like, and there's a scene in the book, and it's not spoiled, like where as Sophie, again, that's an element of it, is she's kind of a journalist and like she's a detective and she's kind of looking into this case, and at one point she's like kind of viewing the crime scenes and to tie that, like if you've seen any of those things, unfortunately the documentary goes into it, like holy shit, like it's fucking brutal, and like again the fact that he's like on TikTok and Instagram like doing funny stuff is insane,
Insane.
but
Yeah, no, how quickly we forget, right? And I mean, I think that was a thing for Sophie too. Like, I wanted her to have an arc in this one. Like, I feel she has an arc in the first one, I want her to have it like kind of a different variation of I want her arc in each volume to be sort of a variation of this theme about like the truth and the dogged pursuit of the truth. And like Sophie in volume one is like she's gonna follow the truth no matter what, and she takes this internship at this news station not because she particularly cares about the news and not like to get like school credit. Her dad has been accused of a crime of like this like Bernie Madoff level embezzlement. Again, a great reference in a all ages book for children. I got a lot of them. We're gonna do Phil Spector in the third book. I'm kidding about that. We're not doing that. But her she everyone thinks her dad's guilty of sin, and that's her dad, and she thinks he's innocent. And so like she's like, well, I'm just going to get this internship because I think that's a good way to prove that he's innocent. Like, the news has made my dad out to be a bad guy, so I'm going to use the news to prove that he's actually a good guy and rub everyone's face in it. And then over the course of that internship, she starts to have this newfound appreciation for the news. And then by the end of the first book, she blows open this big kind of like sci-fi conspiracy that was happening under everyone's noses in Miami. And then for the second book, I kind of wanted her to start like believing her own hype a little bit. Like, she gets some notoriety for, kind of being this whistleblower at the end of the first volume. And so in the second one, she's maybe a little cockier. And, people are coming out of the woodwork and being like, hey, help me. You kind of helped yourself and helped your family. See if you can help my family. And so there's a real like siren song appeal for Sophie in that. And this character in Buried Leads, D.L. Bledsoe, I mean, obviously you look at his name, it's very much like a riff on O.J. Simpson. And, O.J., I think most people would tell you he's like a pretty charming guy in the way that most sociopaths are. He could sort of tell you what you want to hear. And without saying whether or not D.L. Bledsoe is a bad guy in Scoop in the way that O.J. Simpson is in real life, like, he does have those personality traits. He very specifically says some things to Sophie to get her to take his case. And I don't know, for me, those were fun scenes to write. I don't know if anyone else is going to enjoy them on that level. But my dad's a psychologist. I have a degree in psychology, like armchair psychology, but my favorite classes were about abnormal psychology, and you'd learn about sociopaths and just they're like the most charming people in the world, and they'll tell you what you want to hear just to manipulate you and get what they want out of you. And so I love, reading stuff like that and writing stuff like that.
And hopefully not offended Tim, because I know Tim is from Boston, and dare you besmirch Drew Bledsoe with any sort of
Oh yeah, that. Sorry, yeah, Tim. That's a coincidence. That I just wanted something that had two syllables, and there's something that happens later on in the book when they kind of trash DL's house, and there's like a little bit of a pun on the mailbox, and it was all kind of reverse engineered to that. So
there's a
I've got
scene.
no ill will for Boston.
There's a scene later where he jumps, he does crowd surfing, and he injures himself and stuff. Yes, I was living in Massachusetts at that time, and that was a fun time. I talk a lot about Sophie, and I think, again, obviously the main character, she's like kind of the backbone of it, and but she's such a like likable and engrossing character. Even from the first volume, like to the second one, like you absolutely fall in love with this character, and it's so interesting because, again, all this is going on, and she is a 15-year-old teenage girl who is also like bilingual. Like, there's so many aspects to her that I think like telling this narrative would be difficult to kind of get that correctly. Is it something for you kind of getting the voice of a teenage girl who is like multicultural and also kind of tackling things that I think would be easy to kind of like tackle her as an adult? Like, it would be easy to like put her in that mindset, but I think you do an amazing job of still kind of keeping her in the kid mindset, or at times keeping her in a kid mindset who thinks she's an adult and has to be kind of brought down. There's like several scenes where, parents tackling raising a teenage girl. Like, is that difficult to kind of capture that voice specifically?
Maybe at the outset it was. I mean, I feel like, when I write Scoop now, it's kind of weird. Usually when I write comics, I'll do full script, and I'll write, page one, panel one, and do the description and do the dialogue. With Scoop, I almost write it like a radio play. Like, I just hear the Sophie's dialogue in particular, but now pretty much all the characters, and it just kind of flows. And so I just write long jags of dialogue. And then I go back in and I break it into, pages and panels, and figure out like, well, this is a good line for a page turn or whatever, or this is better served like in like a caption, and she'd be off panel or something. But I think, as far as the bilingual thing goes, like I know the name Richard Ashley Hamilton does not scream diversity, but I'm half Cuban. My mom came over from Cuba when she was 7, and so I grew up in a bilingual household, and my grandparents lived next door, and they talked to me in Spanish. So like that part of it is pretty good. And one of the co-publisher at Insight, Vanessa Lopez, she's from South Florida, and she's Cuban, of Cuban background too. And so she and my mom basically proofread all the Spanish in volume one and made sure it was right, and Vanessa kind of proofread volume two. And even in Spanish, there's like differences, like Mexican quote unquote Spanish is different than Cuban Spanish, and there's sort of idioms that are unique to kind of each sort of version of Spanish. So that part of it is kind of fun and easy. But in terms of like, am I writing a credible teenage girl? I don't know. I try to do my best, and then I show it to my wife, and I show it to, my mom and to other people I trust, and I'm just like, does this seem real, or is this like a guy pretending to be a girl? So they keep me honest.
Megan, I think at the very most, having her in like kind of these situations, like obviously there's like tackling minor instances of like relationships with her, but like again approaching it as a kind of very driven and dynamic character, like I think kind of pulls that back and like everyone kind of empathize with her situation. And like speaking of the Spanish as well, like I love that. Again, it is much like the alligator. It's like it is just much part of this world, and like he just drops it in, and like people will have almost like full conversations in it. But like it's with like Pablo's art and everything that's going on, like you can intuit everything that is being said or understand like kind of the tone of things happening, and it just like exists. Like, and it's such a great way to kind of again kind of pull readers in and it feel like at home in this world and this city and this character who's able to kind of drop in and out of that. And like it is again nice not to just like have the text there in like italics or something, be like, oh,
Right,
this
or
happens to
with
be in
those
Spanish,
like
happens to be in
weird
Spanish.
angular brackets around them, which is what they used to do in comics. I'm really happy to hear you say that. I mean, that's the way it is living in Miami. People will come up to you and they will just talk to you in Spanish and just assume that you speak Spanish. And I look like a super white guy, and people will just come up to me and talk to me in Spanish, and it's kind of great. So like, I feel like you don't necessarily need to hang a lantern on all that stuff. Like, you just make it part of the context of the world, And yeah, I'm happy to hear you say that. I think, like kind of putting her in these, in like the dangerous situations and the perilous situations. I mean, that's, very much like I grew up watching Amblin movies, and like those that mess around like the Goonies are, it gets kind of life and death for them, and I feel like you know, I remember being a kid and liking stories like that where the young people are the smartest people in the room and they're the ones that are actually solving things and the parents are always playing catch up. And even with my own sons now, I see that they still respond to that kind of storytelling. You know, it's like that's the way it feels when you're a kid. The whole world is against you. And in Sophie's case, it literally is.
Oh, for sure. Like having, especially now that with the 7-year-old, like he is more interested in stories that either like the kids exist as kids, but they are just tackling, you know, adventures and problems that like anyone would. Like he's still like having younger brothers. He likes Paw Patrol or like, you know, occasionally if something's on, he'll watch it. But like he like hates being talked down to. Like he's like a little teenager in like the 7-year-old body. But like kids, and same with like Goonies. Like we watched Goonies and my wife was like, "Is this appropriate?" And I was like, "I don't know. I guess it's fine." And like we were watching Monster Squad and like the kids using a shotgun. You know, it's like, I don't know. Like, but like as a kid, that's what I liked. Like my dad took me to, Jurassic Park, like a midnight showing on open. I think I was like 6 or something. I don't know. But like, I fucking loved it. Like kids don't generally like being talked down to. And like, even like kids material that isn't like, you know, the big ones like Mr. Rogers. Cause like Mr. Rogers doesn't like fuck with kids. Like Mr. Rogers, like, will like straight up talk to kids and like, that works. And like that's the only, like he doesn't necessarily like respond too well to Sesame Street, but like Mr. Rogers, who's like cornier than that, like he responds to that, and that's because, you know, it specifically talks to him as an adult. And like, so stories like this, and this is something I've been like way more interested in, is like kind of the young adult market for stories in comics, because like that's it, it works on so many levels, and I've read so many things with him that I enjoy, if like as much, if not sometimes more than he does, because like it is such like a worldly approach to it. And like that is achieved more than like, you know, your mainline, like, you know, Scott Snyder Batman, where it works, but like, that's not something like that is picked up by all ages. And like, it doesn't work on multiple levels, but like young adult comics seems to be able to kind of hit the notes that mainstream comics isn't able to hit all the time.
Well, I mean, I am in a complete agreement with you. And, the way it was for me when I was growing up, if I read like Spider-Man or, you know, whatever, Superman or Batman, I was reading the same Superman, Batman, Spider-Man comic that like a 40-year-old would be reading, you know, like there was like just kind of the mainline continuity, and that book appealed to me, and I'm sure it appealed to them too. And so like that's just kind of my approach when I write things now. I don't like to exclude anyone, because first of all, it's hard enough to like get eyeballs on your independent comic book these days anyway, because there's so much great stuff out there. So why am I gonna like block out a potential audience? But I think it's just like what you're describing, like Mr. Rogers or your dad or even my parents, like they didn't insult my intelligence. They didn't talk down to me. They assumed I was intelligent. And I really feel like most kids can hang with this. And so if you tell them that kind of story, it's a story that they're going to enjoy because they feel like they're being respected. But it's also a story that an adult is going to enjoy because they don't feel like it's been dumbed down for anyone either. You know, so like I'm the same way. My wife and I like to watch things with our kids that they enjoy and we enjoy. And maybe we enjoy it in a different level than they do, but we're all still enjoying it, you know?
Yeah, and I think something like Scoop is great because it allows me to introduce my kids to Hall & Oates.
It's never too early. Yeah.
It's fucking, yeah. I cannot get enough Hall & Oates. I mean, and to that, I guess, I feel like at some point, this show is a selfish, like driven show where I just want more of the things I like. So like if I can get people to buy the things I like so I can get more of it, if we could get like a kit series down the line, specifically one where he's like, you know, undercover as Hall & Oates, like that scene, I don't want to spoil anything, I don't know if it has been teased, but there's a scene in the second volume I was 100% there for it. It's like my favorite thing.
I'm glad, because that's one of those things where I'm writing it and I'm like, I doubt anyone else is going to like this the way I do, but you know, same thing, you know, you're selfish with your podcast. I'm selfish with my book. I'm like, well, I guess I came up with this thing for better or for worse. I'm going to put what I find interesting in there. So, yeah, my dad grew up in Philly, and after my mom immigrated from Cuba with her family, they somehow wound up in Philadelphia, and that's where they met. And, you know, Hall & Oates are from Philly, and they're, you know, like institutions there. So I grew up listening to a lot of Hall & Oates, and I remember, you know, my dad playing it all the time, and, you know, it was okay. And then I started listening to it almost ironically, and then I was like, God, this is actually really, really good. And so I've gotten like super deep in their catalog, way more than my parents ever did. And it's definitely obsessive. But yeah, like I just, you know, I'll play Hall & Oates now, and, you know, the songs are still good. And if you play You Make My Dreams Come True, everyone starts kind of like bopping their head to that one, young and old. So I don't know. I feel like there's an eternal, enduring appeal to Hall & Oates. And, you know, if Scoop and Sophie can help share that with the new generation, I feel like my work here is done, guys.
Achieved. And referencing, I think, and I think another thing you do so well, and I'm interested in kind of how you juggle this, is the cast of characters in this. There's a large cast in both volumes, and I feel like they're all kind of stand out, and they all have their own time to shine. Like, Hal's great. Like I said, I love Kit. Like, I'm blanking on it. It's not Wheelie. It's
Whirly.
Like, everyone, especially kind of the news crew, it very much reminds me of, like, I don't know. I was getting like we were talking about young kids. Vernon and from Ninja Turtles, Vernon and. Shit, the girl's name. I can't. Anyway, the like really like dynamic and fun news team, and like there's so many characters. There's like U.S. Navy. There's
It's pronounced Usnavi, and that's that's a real Cuban thing.
Is it difficult, or like for you, like the need to kind of have this like large and engaging cast, and like not only is it make the book fun, like I think everyone kind of gets their time to shine, and they all have their kind of like elements they bring to it, but it's also like a really good character development for Sophie, because she's kind of bouncing off all these characters, and you really get like different elements of her in the story. And that, like, I mean, obviously you're approaching the story, so I don't imagine it's difficult to write all of them, but like kind of juggling all those moments and all those characters, where they are, who they are, and how they interact with Sophie, is that something you wanted early on, or is that kind of something that built out?
No, I totally wanted that early on. And that was, you know, when I was 19 and in college at Miami, I got an internship at CNN. And that's kind of where like the germ for all this was first planted. And there was a whole team, you know, the news team there at CNN Miami. And they were all, each one of them was a character, you know, like they all had weird quirks and personalities. And there's all kinds of like weird politics between them. And so for me, like being 19 years old, I thought this was going to be like this very professional, polished team of reporters and journalists. And they were all professionals, but they were human beings too. And, you know, they had all the weird foibles that go with it. So like, I don't know, I kind of stored a lot of that stuff away. And Hal Ritz is based on this guy, Bob Vito, who is the senior correspondent in CNN Miami at the time. And he kind of took a liking to me and took me under his wing the way Hal takes Sophie under his. So some of them are just based on people I know. Like Kit is very much based on my little brother Chris, who is, you know, now in his 30s, but is still like the biggest tech head and tech geek. And anytime I have an IT issue or anything wrong with my house, like he comes over and solves it. So like some of it's based on people I know, but it's totally what you said too. Like I think kind of the great way to explore character and learn more about Sophie is seeing how she bounces off all these weirdos around her, right? So you know, that's I feel like hopefully, you know, some comedy comes from all that, but a lot of character comes from that too. Not just the establishing these supporting characters and making them feel credible, but also like using them as these different little angles on that prism to kind of look at Sophie differently each time through their eyes and learn a little more about her.
Is that something, I think of this, we just did an interview yesterday with Zach Thompson, and he was talking about he used to work in kind of social media, and he would work with like influencers and having to kind of like corral them. And the current book you come out, I Breathe the Body, like that is kind of the crux of it, and the horror comes from that. And like it was really important to him to have that be honest, and whether it necessarily is understood by the readers, like the people who might happen to work in that, like will get it, or it just feels true to the reader, whether like they get it or not. Like very important to him to kind of like have that aspect. Was that something like kind of working in very personal moments for you, and that being true to the case, like with like it does feel like very much like a news team and kind of the inner workings of that, but also like being away from that now, was there any research that went into kind of getting the feel of what that situation would be like?
You know, a little bit of research, but you know, it was kind of like, I just wanted it to just be credible enough that, you know, hopefully the reader feels like, okay, this person has some experience with like TV news journalism. Just enough so that it all made sense. Like I didn't want, like the goal of Scoop wasn't by the time you're done reading the second volume, like, you know, every single step in terms of like producing a news segment and airing it and how you edit it and what software you use like that. You know, I think that would be like kind of a cool academic exercise for some people, but it was more about just kind of giving us just enough context to like tell an emotional story with Sophie. But you know, the truth is, like, the way news is produced now is very different than the way it was when I was an intern at CNN in like whatever 1997. But the way I got around that was to just make the news station where Sophie interns, WMIA7, just have them be the worst news station in South Florida, and like have the worst equipment, and have, you know, basically be broke, and so they can't afford new equipment. They can't afford to be cutting edge. And so then I could just write them as if they were still like stuck in 1997.
Right. Yeah. I mean, from what I am aware of, all news is fake news now. So I mean, I don't know what.
Right. Yeah. Don't even bother tuning in. Yeah. No, but it's like, it's, you know, wherever you come on that spectrum, you know, like, news definitely has gotten more sensational since then, you know. And like, honestly, it was the OJ thing. Well, first, yeah, it was the OJ trial. Like, that was the birth of the 24-hour news cycle, you know. And then once you had 24 hours of news and the trial was over and he kind of like went off into the sunset in my neighborhood, then it's like, well, how are we going to fill 24 hours of news now? Because we don't have a big story. And so there's all these like talking heads start coming up. And then it wasn't until Johnny Versace got murdered in Miami where they all of a sudden had like a new exciting news story again. And it was very sensationalized. And I actually, my first day interning at CNN was the day Johnny Versace got murdered, which is pretty weird.
Oh, yeah, which is the obviously kind of a plot element in that first volume.
Totally.
And it's so interesting to see, too, because, and I'm sure it's always been a little bit this way, but, like, having this kind of center around a local news agency, like, as we've moved to, like, the 24 hours news cycle that we're in, and even more so now when, like, there's, you know, there's Twitter and social media, like, the local news has become, like, ramped to a new level because they're obviously competing with the 24-hour news. So like it's like more extreme, and you get this in the book kind of like with the competition or what they're covering or how they like, oh, are we going to get picked up for a national story? Like it becomes even like wackier. Like local news is insane.
Insane.
And, like, stuff I'll see sometimes, we have like I'm sure most do, we have like, it's like Channel News, not, I don't know what it is, but it runs 24 hours. This is some like local thing. It like repeats, I think, every hour, and they rotate it like quarters throughout the day or something. But like the stories on there are goofy, and like they make, like, I'm like, I don't know if this isn't news for anybody, but like it's what they have to do now, apparently.
That sounds awful. That sounds awful for whoever has to watch it, and also the poor people who are like cursed to make it, you know?
Yeah, well, they look, yeah, one of my favorite things is following them on Twitter.
On Twitter.
Like the anchors for these like local things and like the shit they have to cover and like their just general day to day. And I would imagine, because then they're like, we have like, you know, the local, it's like Bob Kovacic, and like you see him in the grocery store and people like flipping out. And I'm like, it's some fucking like news anchor for the thing. But he's like a local celebrity and like.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he is a big fish in a small pond, you know. I mean, I follow, I'm not like super social media savvy, but I do follow like some of the local news back in Miami just because, you know, I guess some of it's research purposes for Scoop, but some of it's just funny, you know, like the ridiculous things they have to report on and they have to say it with the same gravitas that they would of like, you know, 9/11 happening or you know, the riot at the Capitol, you know? So even if it's like, you know, local woman goes topless by a schoolyard, you know, like they have to report that like it's like a real news story.
Yeah, well, that would be, yeah, a better news story than the Capitol. We had one guy, we did make local, I think the local Albany, so the day of the inauguration, they were like, oh, there's going to be riots all over the country for the Capitol. So one guy showed up to the Albany Capitol. and he drove like it was like an hour and 45 minutes and like CNN picked it up and like interviewed this like one guy out there with a Trump fight with a fucking
man. Was he pissed off?
Yeah, and he stood out there for a while like, you, oh man, that poor guy, go home. For you kind of putting the first one out and you said having the time off between one and two, but and I don't think it's, but like two, there's obviously more planned, and I think two sets up that greatly. I'm like very excited how it ended and kind of going into it. Like, what is your plan for this series going forward? And like, what's kind of your like hope as a creator, like people either take away from it and kind of want going forward?
Oh yeah. I mean, those are the good questions. You know, I definitely have plans for future volumes, and I sort of treat it like it's very much inspired by Veronica Mars, and mm-hmm. so like each season of Veronica Mars would have like a whole like larger mystery that would unite it, and it'd be introduced in the season premiere, and it would pay off in the season finale, but every episode in between would be kind of like its own wonderful mystery. And some of them would just be sort of standalone things, but some of them there would be like little incremental clues that would lead towards the big payoff of that larger mystery. And that's kind of the model I'm applying to Scoop, which is like each graphic novel has its own standalone mystery, but there's this larger meta mystery of the conspiracy that involves Sophie's dad and, you know, this Matheson Savings and Trust Bank and this weird bunker in the Everglades and time travel and UFOs and alligatoids and the mangrove man and all this other stuff, the crop circles, all these things that we start to introduce in, especially in the second book. And there is kind of like a magic bullet that explains all of those things. And so, you know, my hope is that we can at least get another couple volumes in there to really like tie a bow on that larger mystery. And then once we do that, I, you know, kind of have designs for another big mystery after that, which would, you know, occupy another three or four graphic novels if we should be so lucky. So that's kind of the hope for the book. But, you know, in terms of like what people get from it, Anthony Fauci, you know, kind of become like almost like a rock star, you know, with all the coronavirus updates and kind of the, you know, they would cut to him sort of grinning and bearing it as like, you know, Trump was saying that people should inject themselves with bleach or, you know, whatever. And now, you know, he's kind of like, you know, sort of unleashed and able to really report facts and science and all that. But during all of last year, like with Fauci being a public figure, this whole new generation of people have been applying to medical school, and like in record numbers, it's like a spike in medical school applications and acceptances, and they call it the Fauci effect. And, you know, it's basically like this guy just being so knowledgeable and so good at his job has inspired what looks like a whole new generation of doctors, which is amazing, and healthcare workers. And so, I don't know that Scoop will have like that kind of effect, but I would love for, if it's young people, young girls, young boys reading this, and they get inspired to maybe have a career in journalism, or even if it's somebody our age or somebody in college and they're trying to figure out like, what do I want to major in? Like maybe I'll take a journalism 101 class, or somebody who's like, after the 2016 election, a lot of people like, just people who had no aspirations in politics. All of a sudden started running for like the board of education or city council or things like that. Like they were motivated to do something. And so I don't know, hopefully there's at least one reader out there. They read Scoop and they're like, I'm interested in journalism. I'm gonna check this out and contribute to it. I think that would be great. I feel like journalists have come under fire in the past few years, sometimes with merit, but most of the times with not, and they've been kind of characterized as the enemy. And I feel like we need a whole new generation of journalists out there who are not about all that sensational stuff we were talking about before and all like the local news nonsense, but they're really out there to just give like fair and balanced and unbiased reporting of the facts so that the rest of us can be informed and lead fuller, more well-rounded lives.
Yeah, that would be great. But I think a bigger, like, if we could get a more Hall and Oates cover bands, I think
Well,
that's the real thing
that
we should take away.
too.
I was reading about the Fauci effect and I was like, oh, that's interesting. Hopefully there's a like student loan debt effect where all these people are now going to be
coming.
doctors and be drowning in debt. I mean, we could do something about that. That would be nice.
Yeah, well, that's like the next hurdle, right? But yeah, at least people are interested because I feel like, for a while, everyone just wanted to be an influencer,
Right, right.
and not be like a doctor or like an astronaut or, who says they want to do that anymore?
More, at least at the very least, more people would be interested in facts and science would be great. So from that very thoughtful response and question, I'll let Tim ask his final question.
All right,
All
so
right, so
Richard,
Richard,
gun to your
gun to your
head.
head.
If you were forced for
forced for
one
like one
episode
episode
of Two and a Half
Two and a
Men,
Half
what would
Men, what
happen?
would happen?
Well, first of all, you really would need to put a gun to my head to make me watch Two and a Half Men. I've never seen. So you've changed it from Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, it's new for 2021. We're doing a more difficult question.
Is this Two and a Half Men with Charlie Sheen or with Was it Ashton Kutcher? Is that who replaced him?
Yeah, I mean whatever you
Yeah,
feel
dealer's
like. I
choice,
mean,
whatever you want.
yeah, I'm. I mean, both are great quality. I mean, I don't know what you're trying to assert there.
Oh yeah, no, I say that free of any judgment. So what's the question? Like, if I had to write an episode?
Yeah, what would
What
take
would
place?
take place?
Oh my God. I don't know. I guess. And John Cryer's on the show, right?
Yes.
Yes.
He's
Yes.
funny. I don't know. I would just probably make it about John Cryer and have it be revealed that he's actually Lex Luthor's nephew, which I think he was in Superman 4. And this whole whatever that he's living with another man and a half is just like a witness protection program thing to protect him from Uncle Lex. And then, but Lex finds out about it, and he's gonna do that plot from the first Donner Superman movie where he's gonna knock California off the map and create like new waterfront property in, like with Arizona or whatever. Did they live in California, right?
I
I
believe
could
so.
not. I could not
Have
tell
you
you.
guys even watched the show?
No.
I've seen some of it. I know they live on a beach house, or
All right,
they live in a
so
beach
I
house.
think it's safe to assume they're on the West Coast. So yeah, so Lex Luthor is finds his nephew hiding out there with the Two and a Half Men, and he's going to obliterate them off the map. And then it's not Superman, but it's Charlie Sheen dressed like Superman, which he did in Hot Shots Part One, and he has to fly around the Earth backwards many, many times. And he saves them. and he rejoins the cast, and he and Ashton Kutcher, and they all get along, and now it's Three and a Half Men. I like happy endings.
That would be a good series from now. That show's off the air, right? I assume so.
It's like a big budget show, right? They do like $100 million an episode.
I think when that was like the big news with Kutcher coming on or whatever. I'm into that. Like, I would like more than anything, like, just, and they would have had this started from the beginning, but I would like a just like everyday documentary following John Cryer, because he seems like a genuinely nice and funny man, and for him to have to be on the set with Charlie Sheen every day, like, he seemed, and like, he was just like, from what I gather, like, the, like, his character was just to be the like shit upon person. I would just love to know, like, what that.
Well, he's made a whole career out of that. God bless him.
Yeah.
But he actually plays Lex Luthor now, like, on the CW shows, and he's awesome.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. They do some.
Hold on, he was in Hot Shots with Charlie Sheen. He was Washout. Yeah.
She. See, and that's is that show
that's
just Hot CBS?
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah. No wonder they had, what I assume is great chemistry. I never saw the show, but it was popular. They must have good chemistry. It started on Hot Shots. I'm going to watch Hot Shots now. That's it. Yeah. It's probably on Netflix.
Probably.
Are you going to ask me about Ghostbusters now?
I mean, you can. You're more. I mean, well, it depends on your answer, but you're more than welcome to.
I like Ghostbusters too. I do not think it's as good.
Better
a movie
than Ghostbusters.
As
Ghostbusters. Better than Ghostbusters. 1.
No. It's but that's like, you know, you can't. What sequel is better than the original? You can count them on one hand, right? It's like Godfather 2. Everyone says Aliens. I personally think it was better than Alien. But I do think, like, as far as sequels go, Ghostbusters 2 is fun. You know, like, it's not a total retread of the first movie. And they did that thing where they actually said it, like, it's like 5 years after Ghostbusters 1, right?
Yeah.
And I had never seen that before in a sequel. Like, I don't know, there could be a giant blind spot, but I can't think of it, you know, like Back to the Future 2 takes place immediately after the events of Back to the Future 1, right? And Rambo 2, I don't think it matters when it takes place after First Blood. But Ghostbusters 2, I'm sorry, I've been giving this a lot of thought. I was anticipating this question, so we're going to talk about it, okay? You guys don't have anything better to do, right?
No.
Keep going. So I loved in Ghostbusters 2 that they cut to 5 years later and that the Ghostbusters were disbanded. And that was like a mind blower to me, because you just assume at the end of Ghostbusters 1, all New York's cheering for them and Sigourney Weaver's, you know, kissing Bill Murray and like everything's gonna be great. Rick Moranis, he's okay. And then 5 years later, they're all split up. I thought that was a really cool thing. And I like, as a fan, I thought that was cool. And I just think as a storytelling device, you get to have the fun of like getting the band back together. So I really like that aspect of it. And I thought Viggo the Carpathian was creepy. And what's the actor's name? Peter McNichol. He's Janosch. He's really funny in it. You know, like, I don't know. There was cool stuff in it. You know, maybe not enough Bill Murray in it. But you get more time with Winston, and Winston is really funny when they go underground.
Listen, you're preaching to the choir, sir. I again, Winston, hands down best Ghostbuster. He's there for the money. He's the foil. He's the one. He's talking about Twinkies. Again, you get more. It's, I think, for me, because I was obviously very young when it came out, and I was so into the real Ghostbusters. Like, that was closer to the goofiness of real Ghostbusters. That soundtrack, there's nothing that beats that first soundtrack is garbage compared to two. You get so much Bobby Brown. That's all you need. Aside from him being a terrible person.
Well, let's not say anything we can't take back, but about the soundtrack for not about Bobby Brown. I don't know, man. I still think the soundtrack of the first Ghostbusters for me is better. I will meet you halfway on the movies, but for the soundtracks, I gotta draw a line in the sand. But there's, you know, it's good. You know, like more and more, my favorite part of Ghostbusters 1, it's just when Ray and Winston are driving in the Ecto-1 and they're quoting like scripture. And it's kind of like a creepy scene. You kind of don't even need it, but it's like shot at twilight. And there's like the Ray Parker Jr. song starts to play. It's not the main Ghostbusters one, it's the other one. And it's just kind of like a very like ominous moment between these two guys. I don't know, I just think that's really cool. But anyway.
Well, not
Kyle,
really.
is
Winston
Winston still your
still your
favorite,
favorite,
even
even
though
though
he
he
turned
turned
down
down
the interview for the
interview for the
show?
show? Well, I mean, his publicist turned it down. I don't know if he, yeah. I mean, she quote, very politely passed. So, I mean, she very politely said no.
No, just reach out on social media directly.
Yeah, I mean, what has he got going on? I'm sure he's in, I know he's in Afterlife, so,
Yeah, I don't know. I think he would be happy to talk. I mean, don't maybe don't ask him only Ghostbusters questions, you know, like throw in the hand that rocks the cradle and like, you know, ask him what he's working on now. But you know, he's a good actor.
Well, I feel like that would be it would be the instance where they would say yes, and I'd be like, oh fuck, I have to actually do that. That's like the one
Do that. That's
time,
like the one time.
very early on. And this is when I was working with the Death of Comics, and it was like I started doing interviews, and I was like, hey, you know, I like doing this. Oh, Paul Scheer put out a book. I should ask Paul Scheer if he wants to do it. He's not gonna say yes. Oh, he said yes. Oh, he's gonna call me from the set of a show he's working on. Cool. I got no fucking idea how to interview Paul Scheer. So it
Really
was
painted
awful.
yourself into that corner. Yeah,
Yes.
yes.
So it was awful, and it
Yeah.
was really shitty because I was like, that was still when I was like writing all my. I was like, oh, I gotta have all my questions written out. And then he would answer them. He would answer like one question that I had written, and it was like out of order, and I'm like trying to like delete questions, and there's like tons of dead air. So yes,
Well, that
but it
was the
would be
job.
a test. Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. It was all for Ernie Hudson, but the more important thing than getting Ernie Hudson or seeing Afterlife, I don't know if that's gonna be good or bad. I don't even know if it's coming out. I think it got pushed to November. But what isn't pushed to November is Scoop Volume 2, February 23rd. Like I said, it's fucking great. I'm very excited for it again because, like I said, I like to own nice things. But also, like again, quietly, Insight puts out really great books. And so, like, hopefully, again, that is a jumping on point for people to come onto it. And like I said, just get more of it out there. I am excited for more Scoop. I'm excited for like I think like these first two, like if you need proof of like being able to tell good, coherent stories with great characters and like fun, like unique storytelling elements, like this is a good showcase for that. So I would like to see more Richard Hamilton stuff. So how do we do that? So go pick up Scoop Volume 2 so I can get more because that's all I care about.
All I care about.
Yeah, well, that's high praise, and yeah, pick it up. It's a beautiful book. Insight puts out really nice comics. It's really great paper stock, and the you know covers have spot gloss on them, and you know it's volume two is only $12.99 for 92 pages of story and art. I think it's a pretty good bargain. But you
That is,
might
that
be
is.
able to get it a little cheaper if you pre-ordered it at your local comic shop, or if you go to, bookshop.org or stuff like that. But it's, you know, everyone worked really hard to give everyone good value for their dollar, especially now during a pandemic and stuff. So yeah, I hope people read it and check it out and enjoy it. And if enough do, then we can keep telling more stories, which I would love nothing more than to do that.
And the whole Ghostbuster talk threw me off. I got too excited. I forgot if people want to get in touch with you and find out more about Scoop, what could they do? I just got so excited.
Yeah, well, I'm terrible at it, but I am on Twitter at Regards Richard, so you can find me on there. Just be a little patient with me. I'm not on as regularly, I guess, as maybe I should be. You know, you can for Scoop, you know, you can pre-order it at your comic shop. It's carried by Diamond. You know, you can always, of course, get it from Amazon or Barnes and Noble or whatever. But I think it's bookshop.org is a great resource. It's you can order the books online, but it supports local bookstores in your neighborhood. So that's always a good thing. So I would start at your local comic shop, and if you don't have one, go use those other resources. And then there's also insightcomics.com and insighteditions.com, and you can get it on there.
Yeah, and speaking of people who are bad at social media, Tim, where can we find you?
I write about comics over at Comics Pit, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madera.
Yeah, and we are the worst at it. We have Twitter at pages_panels, yep, and then you can go to anchor.fm/pages and panels. That's an easy way to kind of find all the places you can listen to the podcast. You can listen to it on there, but you can also, at this point, we're on everything you could listen to podcasts on. And again, at this point, eventually I'll stop mentioning because I'll forget and I'm lazy. New show, Is It Too Bad, where me and my childhood friend are listening to every track from Nickelback in their discography to find out if they are the worst band of all time. Spoiler, 1.5 albums in so far. They're pretty bad. But,
Well, they're no Hall & Oates, that's for sure.
Yeah, so we'll find out. But who knows? Apparently they have 9 fucking albums, so we'll figure it out. Again, more importantly than that, because if you listen to that show, you have to listen to Nickelback because I cut all the songs in as well. So that's like a deterrent for, I would think, for people. But so if you want something good, it is to pick up Volume 1, Volume 2 of Scoop. Like I said, it's like, again, I read these books and I'm like, why isn't this not like one of the most popular books? It's fucking great. Why do people, I just get like really frustrated. And I realize there's so many good books out there. Again, hopefully you pick it up and enjoy it as much as I did and obsess over. And I know I don't speak for Tim. I know Tim enjoyed it, but
it was good. It was a lot of fun.
Tim, did you enjoy it?
Yeah. I like teen detective, like youth stories. It's fun.
Cool. Yes. Thank you guys. I appreciate it. Thanks for helping us spread the word on Scoop.
No problem, man. And thanks so much for joining us. Tim, I promise, I know I've been saying it for like over a year now, but we'll cover George Lopez next episode, I promise, buddy.
I can't wait.
Yeah. Ooh, I got bad news.